just fill me over another year. What is this that I can't see? With icicle hands taking hold of me. Well, I am dead, none can accept. I open the door to hear or hear. Who dare someone could be? Don't you wait till you call me another day. The children pray the preacher preach.
Down, 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 down
Savior, another year.
Following is a previously broadcast program.
Hello, I'm Peter Jibbe, and we're talking with vocalist Diamanda Galas from her home in New York today. Say hello, Diamanda.
Hi there.
All right. Just to begin, I've been a big fan of your work, at least since the release of The Litanies of Satan on Metalanguage. I think it was back in 82. And it was out of print really fast, so I had to tape a friend's copy, sorry. as I've been listening to your stuff over the years and reading about you in magazines and what have you, I saw some video stuff. I've always felt that when I try to situate the kind of stuff you're doing, I always think of it in terms of resistance, transgression, kind of a vehement refusal of constraints. The way you use your voice, which is clearly a classically trained voice, a voice that's been worked on, you use it in ways that sort of step outside of what I understand as traditional ideas about singing songs.
Right.
And when I heard Litanies of Satan, it was, you know, because I've read Baudelaire as well, I translated him. Mm. And, you know, that whole poem to me is about an invocation of this great spirit of rebellion and so on.
Yes. Oh, ça t'en profite de ma longue misère.
Uh-huh.
That's saying it's not just pity on my long distress, but it's Satan, the god of the resistance of those who are considered to be powerless, of the hunted criminal, of the outlaws.
Well, the whole,
you know, as opposed to his brother, which he makes reference to in Abel and Cain too. In this piece, Abel and Cain, who is considered to be the one with who is in the right, who is the just man, but who in fact is the parasite.
Yeah, and that whole line in that poem about who gives that calm demeanor to the condemned.
Yes.
I mean, that whole thing is tied up in ideas of resisting the sort of the structures of power.
It's precisely why I did it, and it was misunderstood by many people, of course, naturally, but it definitely was a precursor for the rest of my work.
Yeah, I would see it that way. I mean, but that whole thing also got you pegged as that sort of satanic diva figure, which has got to be pretty irritating.
Well, you know what I'm saying? There's going to be so many misunderstandings in this business. As long as they keep me entertained, I don't object too thoroughly.
Mm-hmm. And your new album, The Singer, you rework black spiritual songs and blues music, which is also a music that's really rooted in the resistance of oppressed communities and stuff.
Right.
Is this when you chose to work on this kind of material, obviously there's probably a love for that kind of music, but there's also a consciousness, I think, of that kind of tradition that you want to work from.
Right.
So that's just something I think that we've got to make clear in terms of a whole notion. I think your work is talking about resistance, and you will pick up on that again. When I was reading your interview in the Angry Women issue of Research, which was a really great interview, by the way.
Thank you. I was open to much contention.
Was it?
What
Andrea's a fun interviewer, too. She always, like, is not too shy about asking probing questions and things.
Yes, I like Andrea. She's a good friend of mine.
In that interview, you talked about a whole concept of moirology, this sort of Greek tragedy.
Eroloia, this is a Greek music of mourning.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could expand on that, because it's not something I'm familiar with. I don't think a lot of people know exactly what that is.
Eroloia music is music that is music of mourning, but it is mourning. It is music that speaks the anger of the dead, and so the women are not mourning for the dead, but they are speaking the words of the dead, the anger of the dead. And it was looked down upon and feared by the patriarchal community because it was seen as inspiring revenge for the dead, which is what it was designed to do, rather than in speaking in a very kind of innocuous way about the soul as representing just the death of Christ in a symbolic sense. It was more the spirit of someone angry and living.
So in fact, it's not the kind of traditional mourning that we think of in terms of a resignation or an acceptance of death or whatever. It's an active.
That has never had a part in the Greek tradition of mourning. Never. This is a tradition that came out of Sparta, where my people are from, my mother's people are from, and it's a very violent tradition. And that's what I would say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even in Greek literature, you get that kind of anger for the dead or from the dead, you know, in the Achilles and Patroclus thing. And
right.
It's a whole different tradition from what people are used to, I think, or what people are familiar with anyway.
In the composition of Plague Mass, for example, I definitely delineated that very sharply from what is thought of as a Requiem Mass, which is a Mass that is composed primarily for the survivors of the departed to console them in their discussion of their suffering whilst the person was dying at their and that the death of their beloved, whereas the Plague Mass is written for those people living with AIDS, living with the epidemic and fighting against it, those people who are active in the community to prevent further unnecessary deaths, unfortunately, one day at a time, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, anyone who's done any work in the AIDS movement knows that feeling exactly. Actually, that comment opens up on two separate questions I wanted to ask you. I guess the first one, since we're actually talking about fighting here, maybe I'll put this to you. You've been active with ACT UP New York and
right.
The HIV issues movement and political action and stuff. I just wanted to know if you'd like to talk about that, and in particular, your involvement with the St. Patrick's Cathedral die-in, actually.
Okay. I think that the discussion that we've had ties very neatly into a discussion of Cardinal O'Connor and
Hello.
The position of the Catholic Church, as I will speak of it in New York, which is a position of patronizing, pity, sympathy, discussing people with AIDS as if they are already deceased. There's always a very comfortable manner people have at funerals in discussing. The past, what they couldn't do, what they would have liked to do, etc. But as far as the Catholic Church position dealing with people who are living with AIDS, it's a very it's a very negligent attitude. We interrupted him in the middle of his homily in the service, which is a discussion of caring for the afflicted and how we must sacrifice for the care of the afflicted. And what we did is we went in and did a die-in, and we showed to demonstrate in his house, since he will not come to any of our houses, what to the congregation what the percentage of death is from AIDS. And we did this very peaceably. We were not warned sufficiently. We were arrested. We were taken to, we were put in jail. And I still have a warrant out for my arrest because I am not, I went to many of the proceedings and I did that, but I tend not to really worry about being responsible to the law very much. I mean, it just isn't something I really think about very much, you know.
Yeah.
But this work is very clear. This understanding is very clear. When I put the material there, No More Tickets to the Funeral, in the Plague Mass, it's saying, look at this cross. You do not see a gold memento to past martyrdom. What you should see is flesh and muscle and bone hanging and blood hanging from that crucifixion. And are you there to prevent this? The crucifixion of the innocent, the crucifixions of modern-day saints, in which I see people with AIDS as being you know, representation. These are the people. These are my friends. Were you there? Did you watch it? And on that holy day and on that bloody day, were you a witness? And that's the point that I'm making. And on his dying bed, he asked me, tell all my friends I was fighting to, but to all cowards and voyeurs, there are no more tickets. Funeral. And that's what we're all trying to say. It's like, we're not interested in rhetoric. If people want to spend time every day dealing with this epidemic, because in this epidemic we must all say we are all HIV positive, and be part of the solution. If not, then those persons who will not commit themselves are taking an enemy status. That there's, we don't have any more time for any other sort of, you know, gray areas or, you know, consolation. And these words like sympathy and pity and these words are very, very tiresome. So the position of, you know, of the Catholic Church is one which is very dangerous. It's a position of genocidal position because it's telling, it says to the followers that safe sex and any means at all of preventing the epidemic from spreading all criminal.
Yeah.
It's a very traditional voyeuristic position taken by masters of genocide, of lining up for the last judgment the sinners and the good men, those redeemed by their, you know, righteousness, and by saying, by disavowing things like safe sex and they are basically saying this is we can make an immaculate lineup because there will be no confusion. You know, it's really a, I don't know. I'm speaking philosophically. I think that really the people about the Catholic Church talking about the goodness of taking the bedpans of shit from the dying must be seen as in terms of the shit they're bringing. The hospitals that they establish services in are very dangerous to people I know with AIDS because if a Catholic nurse or the Catholic service sees that that the best thing to do with someone with AIDS is speed them quickly to their death, then things like, you know, painkillers or treating opportunistic infections are not going to be seen, are not seen as being really important. They're just seen as sort of symptoms of evil rather than extremely important messages that need to be treated on a daily basis in order for a person to survive. Because we know that one day that someone will be able to survive by dealing with treating all the opportunistic infections, all the illnesses that come with having AIDS, one by one, someone will suddenly be surviving 15, 10, 15, 20, 25 years instead of this waiting for the mythological cure horseshit. In the meantime, that waiting for the mythological cure horseshit plays neatly into the hands of those people whose, you know, agenda is to wipe out a community that is threatening them as they perceive it threatening them. Community which, in point of fact, has absolutely no interest in them whatsoever.
Which operates quite well entirely on its own.
Oh, exactly. That's the thing. Who needs this fucking interference, you know? Everybody I know fights for themselves. It does very well in terms of, you know, working in support groups. I'm not interested in their fucking words. I'm not interested in their fucking money. You know, and that goes for this idiot asshole, Axl Rose, you know, and that stupid concert up in London, you know, where suddenly the rock and roll community is going to demonstrate only naturally upon the death of someone.
Well, hello.
Who therefore will be no longer, you know, seen as a fraternal and therefore won't threaten their images of, you know, heterosexuality, they're going to see, they're going to now, you know, speak for the epidemic, and they're going to support this person, and it's nauseating. Nobody I know is in a hospital, nobody I know with AIDS is interested in taking a dime from those motherfuckers, man. You know, the only way I will accept money from Axl Rose is if he were to get up on stage and suck my ass and everybody I know who's been dealing with this fucking epidemic for at least 2 hours, and then we can collect the money that everyone will pay to see that demonstration and then use it. But nobody wants him to open his stupid fucking mouth, unless it's just to kiss somebody's ass.
Yeah, well, he's such a posturing idiot anyway. I have a real problem.
With a fucking small penis complex. He gives a fuck, you know. It's like, as far as I'm concerned, this tradition of the male rock star is really over anyway. The heterosexual male rock star, it's over. Nobody wants to see it anymore. They represent nothing. The expressions of rock and roll and music, this is always meant a music of resistance, just as we spoke of the Baudelaire piece. It's supposed to have meant that, fighting from the underground, a guerrilla warfare, which we know about coming out of the whole AIDS community. This is something that the music has been about since its incipient stages as military music, you know, within the black community, and with any community. It's always been music to survive with, music from the fucking margin, music that threatens danger to people who are trying to bury you alive. That's what it is. It's, you know, it's, what's it have to do with these fucking executive businessmen with long hair? I don't know, you know, but I won't pay to see that motherfucker jerk it off in my face. I don't want to see it.
No.
You know, I'm not interested.
How do you say detired? I mean, that's the whole heavy metal thing. Let's not get going.
Honey, they're just a bunch of rent boys. You know, I mean, they should. I just laugh.
And they're not good at their job.
I provide sexual services to all my friends. The only thing is that my friends would want to charge them, so it's probably impossible, no matter how you look at it.
It's not going to work, really.
No, I'd like to see them tied up and beaten, humiliated, and sodomized with fucking soldering irons by my friends and me just for sport. But, you know, there's always a chance that saying this to the mainstream media will make me look like a fanatic and not considered responsible.
You have
That's really nothing I worry about on a day-to-day basis, but, you know.
Well, you have an open forum here. You have an open forum on this show, really. It's like, work, Miss Honey. Okay, back on track. Okay, so we were just talking about the church and the plague mass, so that leads in pretty nicely. I'd like to know more about the plague mass. You set out, as you said, to create a piece that was about anger rather than resignation in the face of death, etc.
It deals with a geography of a plague mentality. It shows a quarantine mentality. This is something that Requiem Masses don't generally deal with, and that's why it's specifically a plague mass.
Mm-hmm.
Deals with a person struggling to survive in a hostile environment, as I mentioned before, which seeks to bury him alive in every moment, and deals with fighting against that whole mentality that we see a lot in New York, where all these, you know, congressmen and so forth are constantly voting for the shelters on the outside of the city, in which everyone from the mentally ill to people with TB to people with AIDS would be put so nobody can see them, and then just they can be destroyed, so the little death camps on the outside of the city, you know, that kind of shit, you know. So that's it. The work has been presented far too infrequently in America. It's been performed twice at St. John the Divine's.
Yeah, that's something I wanted to ask you about later, too.
Huh?
That's something I wanted to ask you about later as well, but we can get to that later.
And in New York at the Kitchen for a while, but in America otherwise it's been performed maybe 6 times. People are afraid of the work. They're afraid of the use of my use of Leviticus, which is the Book of Laws, most as a precursor for fundamentalists in the Catholic Church in dealing with the epidemic, and the book that is a book that separates, quote, the clean from the unclean, used as a book that condemns homosexuality in juxtaposition with the Psalms, which are cries to a God invented by despair, invented by madness and by beating. And so that work scares people, and this is juxtaposed with my own texts, which are considered blasphemous texts. So, you know, I mean, not to mention just this, the fact that the art world in the tendency in America tends to encourage a real pedantic liberal prose, I have to complain about in general, because it's generally written by a sort of breeder mentality to discuss its liberal empathy for people who are, you know, on the underground. And again, you know, that kind of pity is nauseating, and I will not put up with that in my work. And so the work is almost seen in a kind of a too violent, grotesque way, you know, even by the art community. Me laugh in general.
It's true. How did that happen? I mean, presenting a work like this, which is clearly anti-Christian, how did you get a book at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine? I mean, that's quite a coup.
It is a coup. It's a master stroke. But also, St. John the Divine is quite diametric to these other quote holy establishments, in the fact that it is not interested in preaching and talking about what it's doing. It has long been a shelter for people that are homeless. It has provided shelter for people who are political refugees from South America, people coming out of the prison system. It gives a great deal of money to people with AIDS and different AIDS organizations. Mm-hmm. It houses an AIDS memorial that, of course, would be of no relevance unless it were in context with the whole community. But it is in context with the whole community of people living with AIDS, so then that is acceptable and makes sense. It's an incredible establishment. It is diametrically opposed to every belief system coming out of Cardinal O'Connor's little church right now. And as a matter of fact, the relationship between the two has long been of enemy, as an enemy relationship. Paul Moore, who used to be the bishop of that cathedral, has always despised the discussion of AIDS in the Catholic Church as a divine punishment and the practices that have been acted within that understanding.
Yeah. You use the word plague, which I think is a particularly resonant word, and I think it's one that operates pretty powerfully in most of the work that I've heard that it refers to. Because when you say plague, you're saying something, I think, quite different from saying pandemic or epidemic, which is, you know, a very narrow, prosaic kind of medical word. When you use the word plague, you raise issues of theology, of approaches to the thing. You throw into light the whole kind of reactionary attitude of different kinds of Christian communities, government inaction, because the sense of the plague has a sense of the inevitable. So when you use it in that kind of forward way, you are really engaging that in a very...
Well, I'm only discussing it as it appear, as it as treated, as it is.
Exactly, yeah.
As it is treated. It's not treated as cancer. It's treated, although we all know that it's the beginning of people dealing with cancer. There was a very, very plague-like atmosphere, but it's never been by any means on the level of the AIDS epidemic, because this calls into question people's judgment, quote, God's judgment, morality, the morality of persons who see themselves as friends to the movement, to the AIDS activist movement, who are in fact stealing money through things like AIDS benefits, which many times, in most cases, completely exploit people with AIDS, and while greasing their own pockets, and calls into mind a lot of medical research establishment, which are making a lot of money by supposedly doing AIDS research and pharmaceutical research, but are misspending the money to come up with, quote, the big cure. You know, there's just so many different levels of hypocrisy that this this disease has been associated with, you know. And that's it's endless. This is a long discussion. This is a long discussion, a discussion of suicide by media, death by media, in which media does not act as an information source for people with AIDS. In fact, it discusses the impossibility, the so-called impossibility of surviving AIDS. And it discusses the suicides by people who've given up. It discusses the spectacular, sensationalistic aspects of the disease that can only be interesting to people who are, again, not involved in the epidemic and who, you know, use the news for a cheap thrill, you know.
Yeah, well,
because it is, after all, I mean, much of the news is coming on, you know, from the Hollywood angle of selling movies. It's just the same thing. So, you know, it's considered an underground disease. You know, so, I mean, there's that aspect. There's the aspect of that the people I know deal with, I deal with because I came out of, I went through the mental hospital system myself for other things, and I can't get insurance for 3 or 4 years. I haven't had insurance. So I have to somehow come up with money for my own shit, you know, treatment. Yeah. And so people I know can't get insurance. They are, you know, cut off. Their friends treat them like patients, you know, a lot of them. And it's suddenly a totally different relationship. There's so many parameters involved. This conversation could go on for hours.
Yeah. I mean, the issues are so enormous that all you can really do, I guess, is engage them on a daily basis.
That's all you can do is you have to just take it one day at a time, do as much research as you can do, interface with all the people that you know that have this shit going down in their life, with HIV positive, AIDS, or whatever, and that's a full, you know, and try to stay healthy in the process, and realize that resistance to what are considered to be the quote inescapable truths about AIDS is going to reduce stress, because watching the fucking television and reading the mainstream newspapers all the time is enough to put a person in the hospital within a fucking month, you know. I mean, that shit is not going to be an education unless it's very specific media that is known to be providing intelligent information for people with AIDS. That shit will get you in the hole in a second, and it'll get a noose around your neck. It's very important to remain active rather than passive, and those mediums induce passivity.
Exactly. I mean, it's important too. I mean, even recent brain research has indicated the kind of effect that television rays can have on people.
Death for sure.
Yeah.
You know, and so, forget about it.
Yeah, move on. How would you like to discuss having been denounced as a blasphemer and heretic by the Italian government?
I have to go there, actually. I have a very, very small concert planned there in some special place. I'm not sure how it's going to work out. And actually, the record company thinks I should have a bodyguard with me. Actually, I think that might be a bit dramatic, you know. Of course, if they want to pay for it, they can do it. I'm sure they'll resist that temptation. So, that scene, my performance of Plague Mass there, which was one-third in Italian, caused a rather big scandal there from the Christian Democrat Party and from the district commissioner of Boyo Cayano, where this concert took place outside of Florence. And there's the national news say, La cantante blasfema, la cantante maledetta, lo scandalo chiamato galas, you know, this kind of crap. And pictures of the district commissioner and the building in which this thing took place. And you know, I have to say at the same time, all my friends, you know, who were there, the the sodomite faction were cheering when I was saying dami la sodomia, dami la morte, which means give me sodomy or give me death.
Uh-huh.
The guys were like fainting in the aisles, you know, my friends were standing up cheering, but, you know, in a way, you know, fuck them if they want to take it that way, you know, in a way they should take it that way, you know, because my position as far as regarding modern day saints is these are people that I know who are fighting in the AIDS community and are inspiring everyone else to do it, and if they are antagonized by my reinstating the palace of saints, then that's their problem, and they can fucking, you know, faint and collapse and be miserable about it. I mean, the sad thing is that I speak with a voice of compassion, not with metaphorical nuance. Mm-hmm. And the old ladies in Italy who are very strongly involved in the death culture, because Italy and Greece have a lot of respect for in their oldest traditions, which are not clerical traditions, a lot of respect for, you know, death, and yeah. they end suffering, and these women would be totally on my side. Yeah. These women who have been used, incidentally, by the fashion industry, there was a fashion ad, and they used four or five of these Sicilian women, and they had them sitting there, you know, discussing as a photograph to show their compassion for people with AIDS, you know, or their sons, and they were used in a fashion ad with Linda Evangelista to sell clothing, and who cried and screamed at that as being total fucking sacrilege, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then we also have to sit with these assholes, incidentally, this is a parenthesis, but I have to say this because I've been burning the Benetton ads.
Yeah.
assholes at Benetton with this cheap, vulgar, two-page photo of a boy dying from AIDS, who's died from AIDS, and his father and his mother and his sister crying. And, you know, this is supposed to, like, raise consciousness about AIDS in Spin magazine, you know?
Yeah.
Puke.
Yeah, it's just...
You know, that's not sacrilege?
Yeah, it really is. It's complete blasphemy. I mean,
that's blasphemy.
It's, yeah. We actually discussed that on the radio show once, and me and my guest had a serious difference of opinion about it. But anyway, let's backtrack a bit. I'd like to talk particularly about, for just a moment anyway, about your musical training, because you can be distinguished from a lot of other recording artists out there right now by the fact that you have a very strong formation in musical technique. And I mean, you'd worked with Globacar and that opera and so forth.
Right. I worked with Globacar and Zanuckis. I came up doing music since I was 5 years old, so it's, you know, I have a background. I studied with my father, who, you know, we used to do a lot of concerts of blues stuff together in New Orleans music. New Orleans, which is the interface of, like, black music and European, you know, experimental music to some degree. I've always felt that. And we have... and European classical music as well. We came up believing that a musician plays everything he or she hears. You know, that's just it. He taught me. I played with him, his band, and then later played at the same time with studying classical music, much as the New Orleans training of musicians was, and is. And, you know, eventually I was playing with a lot of guys doing what was considered the free jazz scene, and guys that I really respect, you know, Butch Morris, Mark Dresser, a couple times with David Murray, a bunch of different guys, Roberto Miranda played with Horace Tapscott, Bobby Bradford, who was playing with Ornette at the time, a lot of different people. I realized that the voice could go further than the piano for the interest that I had, which were the most visceral kind of expression.
Yeah.
You know? And I felt the voice was going to do that, and it was going to do it more impeccably than, you know, even the guys that came out of the post-Ira Ornette tradition. And so I developed the voice very, as a as a very athletic instrument and to work successfully within that tradition, in which, man, if you were a saxophone player, you had to be a motherfucker, man, you know, so the same for a singer, you know, but also use the voice in more unmatrixed ways so that we speak more in reference to the Artaudian theaters or, you know, Baudelaire, what Baudelaire would have conceived of as expression of the voice in the most direct way, as poetry itself,
yeah,
as the most direct medium for thought.
Okay. In this line as well, I remember reading a little while back in an interview with you. I think it was an Hearsay, but I'm not sure of that. And you were ragging on the technical incompetence of a lot of pop or music actuelle people.
Yeah.
It seemed to me that you were thinking, or that you were saying, that it was just so much like, let's have more chainsaw in the mix, industrial music, macho stuff happening.
What was I saying?
Well, that's not your quote. That's me rereading you.
Oh. No. I didn't recognize the chainsaw, darling. I just wondered where that came in.
No, that's just me rereading you. Because, I mean, so much of that music is a question of just, like, you know, grinding the levels up and throwing some machinery into the mix.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we all like high levels, and I use them for my work. But I, you know, I try to have a very – I work with very people with good ears, you know. I mean, you got to – it's not just enough to have, quote, you know, noise. You got to articulate that shit so it's music, you know.
Yeah.
So when I came out – doing music, the music I was doing, people would call noise because they said that it was so out, you know, they couldn't hear it. And I'm saying, okay, so you couldn't hear it as anything but noise because, you know, you can't hear. And now I find it funny that people who are, like, actually, you know, don't know how to deal with sound in a very sophisticated way, just kind of like churning out a bunch of shit and playing it up loud. I always think that's kind of funny, you know, because we were struggling with making people see the shit as music years ago.
Yeah.
And now these people are doing noise and it's like, okay, but it's, you know, fine. You know, if they want to do that, that's fine. But it, you know, it really shouldn't be confused with what I'm doing with,
well, that's,
you know,
the point,
with
yeah.
my stuff.
Yeah, because I remember having discussions about that very thing when people would lump you in with, well, I don't know if I should really be naming names, but like certain groups, like, for example, Soviet France or Non or people like that, who are doing something really quite different from what you're doing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Non's done some good experiments with, he does a lot of really interesting experiments, and we all do experiments, you know, because that's really fun. I do some really, like, I've done a lot of vocal experiments, and I continue, and it's part of my work, you know, but I approach it from a lot of different directions at the same time, and, you know, I have a record I'm going to do called Speed Screams, which are one-minute performances of, you know, most high-energy vocal work you'll ever hear, you know, and I've done that kind of shit for years, and I keep doing it, and I love it, but still, the direction is still, because of Ben having done music since I was a kid, it's still, when I say a musical direction, I don't mean that in a sentimental sense, but I mean it in terms of just a kind of intuitive organization of sound that makes it really interesting, and that is something that I'm certainly committed to, as any composer like Xenakis would be, and is, who has done work for large orchestras, who's done work with computer music, has done work, electronics work, like Bohors, which was really like a heavily influential piece of music, which, I mean, basically is a precursor to all this stuff that people think they're doing when they say use facile expressions like industrial music.
Yeah.
I mean, are these people familiar with, you know, GRM in Paris or Pionri or any of these people? I doubt it, you know.
Yeah. Well, this is the whole issue, is one of rigor, I think, and of seriousness.
It, honey, rigor and discipline, my two favorite words.
Because you ain't going to do nothing without them. I mean,
You're not going to be Mike Tyson either, you know. It's like anyone in the Bronx could sit there and want to be a bad fighter and be a tough guy, but if you want to be, you know, heavyweight champion, you got to work your head off. Poor thing, this thing is kind of like directed into a lot of wrong directions too, isn't she? So she's going to be fighting for the life in prison for a while, but he deserves it. He deserves that.
Hello. Corbière, de Nerval, Baudelaire, right. Artaud. People come up all the time, and what's interesting about their work for me is the kind of level of intensity that they have, and a certain history of as well of mental problems and sort of a very serious exploration of, you know, the subject of consciousness and stuff.
An extreme, you know, they work in an dealing, when they talk about consciousness, it's like extreme levels of pushing rigor to see the truth, and most especially when we don't want to. It's just part of their aesthetic or ascetic doctrine, and it's part of mine, and that's why, you know, I push the music so hard and I push the voice, and it's kind of like going to the outer limits of the soul. You know, you could even call it an extremely hedonistic enterprise, you know, it is, and but you have to know how to get there. I think you could talk about almost anything that way.
Yeah, and it's interesting because that's a whole it's a whole tradition of a French literature that's not one that's well known in China.
Is it?
No. I mean, I remember reading like de Nerval and even more obscure people like Petrus Borel and things, and no one knew who the hell I was talking about.
Yeah, you know? I know, and not that otherwise it would be misappropriated by idiots in the rock and roll world who think that, you know, Baudelaire was all about how he dressed, you know, or whether he smoked dope, you know. Who the fuck hasn't smoked dope? Who gives a damn? You know, that doesn't make you a goddamn poet, you know.
No.
Who cares? You know, the guy was like, that's nothing new. These guys are really great visionaries and
disciplined writers. I mean, who worked on
writers,
their work.
Thank you. I mean, it's not like, you know, it's very, I don't know, people don't understand that you get high from discipline. I guess only people in the S&M community really know that.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that people in the art world don't know that. It's funny. Or the rock world. It's funny because...
Well, the vast majority of people never push themselves hard enough to find that.
Yeah.
You know?
And of course, I will charge people for pushing them to their limits. But we'll go into that another time.
Hello. It's a nice position to be in.
Yes.
Sorry. Anyway, yeah, we were talking about actually, this is something you brought up as well a little while ago. When we were talking about sort of like this extreme work on consciousness done by some of these quote unquote decadent or mid to late symbolist poets. And when I hear some of your music, and you've commented on this as well, I think a couple of times, there are things that happen that sound sort of like a speaking in tongues thing or a trance state.
Right.
And I think it was also in the interview, actually, in research, I'm not sure of that, but I think I read it there. You talk about a whole shamanic kind of musical tradition.
Right.
So do you work from this in a very conscious way? Do you, for example, like go into trance states and perform like Zev has said he does, or?
I think that anyone who is committed to the work, you know, and creating something that is larger than themselves is going to go beyond themselves. Know, beyond themselves, and if by saying going beyond themselves in extreme concentration that is trance, yes, I mean, it feels like what that is, you know, what that word is. I haven't used the word very much in the discussion of my work because it definitely does not include all the other discipline that makes whatever that trance state interesting to anyone besides yourself. So, you know, I would never refer to a group of artists as, quote, for example, trance artists, because I'm sure that New Age composers also consider themselves to be, quote, trance artists.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I'm much more interested in, you know, discussing the power of it. But extreme concentration, including interfaced with, you know, physical power and discipline and knowing what the fuck you're talking about can push you out there into another place.
Yeah.
Definitely, you know.
And I think that's a more valuable thing to say than to use words like trance as well, because you're always in the danger of falling into like some kind of really muddle-minded New Age jargon when you talk about that.
Oh, man, you're not kidding. And not only that, you know, any idiot who has a drink can sit up there and say that he sings in a trance, you know. God, I've heard it, you know. And every time I hear it, I want to just, like, say, well, take your fucking trance somewhere else, Dorothy. I don't want to hear about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I've been to those concerts, I think.
Haven't we all? Oh, please. Someone comes over and decides to show us their new fucking innovation, you know, and it's like, trick or trade, pay up front, get out of here.
Oh, shit, yes. Okay. In addition to your own performance and recording work, you've done a lot of work on film stuff, too. Like, you did Derek Jarman's Last of England, Wes Craven's A Serpent in the Rainbow.
Right.
You've done stuff for Rosa von Pronheim.
Right.
I mean, this may seem like kind of strange and obvious question, but it seems to me that working for film must be a very different kind of thing for you, because your work is often conveyed with so much personality.
Right.
And when you have to do film work, don't you feel like you have to step back and put forward something that will assimilate itself into another person's project or into another format?
Very good. That's a very good point. And in so saying, I should say that I never composed music for either of these people. They used recordings from my previous recordings from Mask of the Red Death, from Plague Mass. I gave them permission to use it, but I never composed music for their films. You know, Derek Jarman wanted also to use the piece that I wrote for my brother, Blind Man's Cry, but I didn't want him to use it because I felt it should only be in my context, really.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, and Rosa used my work with David Ronarovich. I still haven't seen that. Silence Equals Death. David, he used my music in that film for David's sequence, but I believe in David, so I'm sure that it was well used. And you know, what other context? Let's see, I think I did an interview for his film. That was a different story. As far as film work is concerned, as far as writing scores for film work, I don't really find that to be something I want to spend too much time doing. I would do it if I were directing my own film.
Yeah.
I would do it if I were directing or presumably acting in a film sequence in which the sound was extremely important, and then I would want to do the sound as well. I have been asked recently by Pressman Films and by some other people about film projects in terms of acting in them, but and I'll find that out, but I am going to be working on a film called Insecta with Scott McCauley, who's an independent producer in New York, who has actually been the art director of The Kitchen for a while, for many years. And he, I'm going to work with him on the script, and we're going to be working with looking for collaborators, and I'd be acting in that and so forth. But it would really be a piece that was created by me and by Scott from the very beginning.
Oh, so it's a whole different undertaking.
Yeah, that's a different. I feel that composers are extremely well equipped to working in the film industry, but not just in the subservient role that they're put in. It's an electronic medium after all, and who better than electronic music composers know about electronic medium? You know, who better? Certainly, as much as a quote. Directors, film directors, theatrical directors, in terms of how the thing can be created from the ground up.
Yeah.
I mean, anyone even seeing, for example, Cape Fear, which I personally loved, cannot possibly think about it without thinking about the Elmer Bernstein adaptation of Bernard Herrmann's soundtrack. You know, you can't even think about it. You know, it's and the way that it's, you know, Bernard Herrmann would have been perfectly capable of working on in a total way, in a complete way, but at that time, you know, it wouldn't have been acceptable most probably to do that. And also, in those times, you know, you're either a composer or you're a performer, or you're now that kind of distinction is being broken down.
Well, by
for me,
people.
It would be most interesting to work in the film and in the auteur way that I like to work on all my projects.
Yeah. Let's see, what else do I have on my list? Oh, here's something I wanted to ask you about, actually. I've seen recently a few photos of you posing with handguns, right?
Right.
And frankly, you look
posing.
A lot...
That's a funny word.
Well, being photographed with handguns.
I know how to use guns. I train with a Navy weapons expert.
Okay. Well, handling or, you know, being photographed with handguns. And you do look a lot better than William Burroughs does with one, by the way.
Thank you, baby. I do love William. I think he's fabulous. I never did until we met a year ago or 2 years ago and talked about Martha Graham for an hour. That was great. I think he's great.
Yeah,
William Burroughs is a real visionary.
He's a powerful writer. He's a powerful, powerful writer. And
powerful. People actually, as they do with most performers and most writers, know only the superficial aspects of his career and his mind. And he's actually some of his best interviews I've read in Gay Sunshine, which is a compilation of a lot of very interesting interviews.
Oh, yeah, back to the guns, though. Yeah, because it's true. I read that interview. It was one of the better ones I've seen, too. But, and somewhere I read recently, you said something about guns as necessity and metaphor.
Right. Now, metaphor in the sense of action, necessity in the fact of just walking down the street in New York City in a place. Now, you know, I don't mean everywhere you have to do that, but in certain places, I think that women and gay men are going to have to really start thinking about, first of all, real protection. You know, it's like, I think the martial arts training is extremely important.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's, as far as I'm concerned, that's the most important thing. The attitude is the most important thing, more than, you know, whether you're handling a gun or a knife or even whether you prefer to work without that. That is so perhaps what I mean by that metaphor is thinking in a predator sense rather than as a victim, you know. But as far as the gun situation is concerned, I think that this is also kind of a necessity because, you know, I mean, unfortunately, you know, the only people that seem to be really pushing that are, you know, the National Rifle Association or, you know, guys out there that get their guns off the street, you know.
Yeah.
And then the rest of us are told that, you know, we're not supposed to be carrying guns and it's unnecessary and it'll be contributing to crime. And then the cover of Newsweek is invested in, you know, deaths by suicide, you know, and from guns and, you know, guns as, you know, an instrument of suicide. And that's really very, very negative and damaging misinformation to the culture. You know, I think that it's important that, you know, it's that women get together and discuss, you know, rape situation, and gay men discuss, you know, support groups and gay women to support support groups for people who have been raped, but not to try to prevent it in the most efficient way possible is also a mistake.
Yeah. No, I mean, I can see your point. I mean, I've had to, like, pull my way out of a few nasty situations myself.
Yeah, I've been raped.
I don't carry a gun.
I mean, you know, when I was growing up, I lived in a lot of different situations, a lot of dangerous situations, and I'm not talking about it as a liberal. You know, I'm not talking about it in a voice choking with sentiment or tears, you know. It's not that level anymore.
It's not about romance. It's about survival.
Forget it, man. I'm not waiting to do a movie where the nice straight guy comes over and finally at the end of the movie he understands. Fuck him. Throw him out. I don't want anyone's sympathy. I know how to act for myself. I'm not stupid. Women aren't stupid.
No, certainly not. Not the ladies I know, anyway.
Yeah, you're right.
So, well, that covers all the questions I had.
They were excellent questions. Thank you.
Thank you. I mean, thanks for your time. Oh, what's your next project?
Well, I would, in Montreal, as you know, I'll be doing the voice and piano material from the singer and also the work from some of the voice and piano material from Plague Mass. But I would like to, interest the venues who are presenting me and are venues and different places to collaborate to allow me to perform Plague Mass in these cities where people seem to have such a fear of either the expense of it or